Good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Programme. The Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools are here on the dot at 12 o'clock every Saturday to promote and to defend public education. And it's been a very interesting week, hasn't it? In fact, we live in very interesting times because there's been a lot of letters in the paper saying if you want to help disadvantaged children, then it's time you stop funding and overfunding private schools. So the message is actually getting through. The Australian government, of course, have been lagging and lagging and lagging on the state aid issue. But we at the Dogs don't. We just say no state aid for private schools and all state aid for state schools. But there are some very interesting people who are in there fighting. One of the best, of course, is Jane Carrow, who gets coverage on the ABC. Over to Dale and Andy as Jane Carrow and her interviewer.
Thanks, Jane. The interview. Jane Carrow reckons Australia is kidding itself about private schools. As Australia's private school enrolments continue to surge, Jane Carrow remains a vocal defender of public education. The novelist, feminist and social commentator first went to school at Frenchs Forest Public in Sydney's north, then later at Chatswood Public and Forest High in Sydney. Her recent essay, Rich Kid, Poor Kid, The Battle for Public Education, is a call to arms for public schools. What was your tuck shop order?
I would have two sausage rolls with sauce, a cup of chocolate milk and a custard tart.
That sounds so good. What was your favourite subject in high school?
English, of course.
Did you ever get in trouble?
All the time. I was naughty. I used to smoke around the back of the gym with all my mates. I was boy mad. I never stopped talking. I never really did much homework. I was there for a good time, as much as anything else. And I really only ever, and this is still true, put effort into the things that I like. I still do that. That would turn out to be quite a good life strategy.
What do you think is the biggest myth in the debate about public and private schooling in Australia?
That private schools are better. It isn't borne out in any way, and we've been convinced, really, by capitalism and by neoliberalism in particular, that the more you pay for something, the better it is. There are absolutely no statistics that say that because you sent your kids to a private school, they're going to do better in life. There's nothing really that backs that up. That is substantial. We even know, for example, that more kids get into uni from private schools than from public schools. That's not surprising because they select their students and public schools don't. But those from public schools who do get into university tend to outperform their private school peers and are very much more likely to stay the course. They're much less likely to drop out. My favourite reason for that is it's probably a lot easier to go from one underfunded public institution to another underfunded institution rather than going from some of those palaces of luxury to your average university.
People clearly believe it, though. There's a stat very early on in your essay about high school fees making the top five reasons for bankruptcy in Australia.
I think there's a great deal of change going on, and it's very rapid change, and people are frightened, and the private schools are very, very clever at selling on fear. I mean, there are two reasons that people make purchase decisions, and they are, like all decisions made, emotionally and then post-rationalise. The two reasons are hope and fear. Public schools, by their very nature, are actually about hope. They're about hope that we're a good, decent society, that every child can learn, that, you know, we're going to give everyone an opportunity. They were created in an era of hope. Private schools are about fear. They're really gated communities. And so they're about protection. They're about keeping your children away from bad things and influences and trying to protect them as much as you can against all the things that are going to happen to them. You'll hear someone who has chosen a private school over a public school say, for the discipline. Discipline just means that they can get rid of the kids that I don't like. Kids with emotional issues, behavioural issues, whatever it is, the private school can ask them to leave, and they know that the public school can't do that. The public school needs to actually work with those kids, because public schools owe a duty to every single child in Australia, regardless of being nice or supposedly not nice. And so I think it's really driven by anxiety and also by peer pressure. When parents, particularly in a particular area, choose a private school, they put pressure on other parents to do the same thing. The pressure comes from politicians as much as it comes from society in general to send children to private school. The idea that good parents send their kids to private schools, bad parents send their kids to public schools, has created this awful anxiety.
It is interesting that you raise politicians. I'm curious about whether you think that the tenor of this debate has been shaped by the fact that the majority of our politicians, and I suspect a decent chunk of our media class, attended private schools.
Certainly. Well, and that's how you create a ruling class. That's really what we've done through our schooling system. We've created a ruling class. And yeah, there's a kind of oligarchy at the top of Australia. We don't like to acknowledge it. We like to think it doesn't exist, but it does. And it's made up of generations of hugely boys who all went to the same schools. So yes, unfortunately, most of them either went to private schools or sent their children to private schools. We've only had two prime ministers in the last, 50 or 60 years who have not sent their children to private schools, and those are Julia Gillard, who didn't have any children, and Anthony Albanese, who sent his son to public schools from kindergarten to year 12.
In the course of your research, or even just from conversations you've had, are there any points in this debate that you feel are fair enough, or that you'd concede to defenders of the current system?
Not for the defenders of the current system and the way that it is, but I can understand individual parents who have been faced with very difficult situations, particularly when their child has been the victim of bullying or something like that. I do understand that that's when you're going to do whatever you have to do to get your kid out of a really hideous situation. I understand. What really upsets me, of course, that I do need to point out that only some parents have that choice, those who've got some money. So even though I understand why you're doing it, I think it's beholden on you to remember that that is not an option that this system offers every parent or every child. And therefore, do what you have to do for your own children. But for God's sake, don't then leave the public system, as I've seen so many people do, and to justify your own decision and soothe your own guilty feelings, all lefties in particular do this, turn around and throw gasoline and a match into the public school you've left by disparaging it.
You've written that Australia has one of the most segregated education systems in the OECD, which is fascinating to consider at a time when we're having a national conversation about social cohesion. How does our schooling system play into this?
We slice and dice our kids in Australia, I think more than any other country, certainly, obviously, a kinder country, a developed country. We have the OECD warning us about our segregation according to social class, but we also segregate our kids by religion, we segregate our kids by gender, we segregate our kids by ability, for all sorts of reasons. Even things like sporting high schools or performing arts high schools, those are all forms of segregation. So unlike the high school I went to back in the 70s, where just about every kid in the area went, and some parents were managing directors of companies and others were plumbers, and none of us knew or cared. Segregating students does not increase results, and it has very little beneficial effect on the kids who are all in the advantage school in terms of academic performance. But it has a devastating effect on disadvantaged kids who lose all their role models in terms of academics.
You've expressed some concern that private schooling has colluded with middle-class feminism. What do you mean by this?
Yeah, I have a complicated relationship with that particular part of it because I wish it wasn't true. But I also know that it is because feminism, as yet, is an incomplete revolution. So we haven't yet left behind the guilt that we feel around our mothering. And a lot of women, particularly middle-class women, will feel guilty about wanting to put time, effort, and energy into their careers. Private schools offer such a neat little thing you can soothe yourself with. Oh, I'm only working as hard as I do and as many hours as I'm doing this great big job so I can pay the school fees to get my kids a better education. That's another reason to say, oh, it has to be a better education. I make sacrifices to send my child to a private school, which you hear all the time, as if the implication of that is so unpleasant that public school parents don't make sacrifices. Is it really a sacrifice? Because what you're making is a purchase decision. And it's a bit like saying, we made sacrifices to live in this leafy middle-class suburb in this nice house, and we really should get a subsidy to do that because we're a better class of person.
What was your fondest memory of high school?
I'm going to sound like such a nerd, and I promise I didn't do particularly well in the HSC, but I actually think some of my fondest memories are sitting in my English classroom with Miss Frater and my fellow students discussing novels and talking about what we were reading. And particularly, and almost everybody else in my class hated it, but I loved it, Patrick White's The Tree of Man. I absolutely loved that book. We had long and really interesting discussions about what it was about and ordinary people and the wife and the different gender roles that Patrick White might be writing about and all that kind of thing. I really think that I felt very intellectually stimulated by those classes. I promise you those classes are still going on in every public school in Australia, and I'm sure they're going on in private schools too. I don't think that the teaching in one or the other is necessarily all that different, but I think we have an assumption they happen in a private school, and we can't believe they have it at a public school. But of course, they do. She's right, you know. I had so much fun in my English classes. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to Jean Carrow. We might disagree on a few points with her, but she's a great battler for public education. And now we're going to another battler for public education, Trevor Cobald from Canberra. On his Save Our Schools website this week, he has a very interesting lot of information on New South Wales independent schools and how they enrol very, very few low-income students. And Trevor Cobald, who used to work for the Productivity Commission, is a facts and figures man, and here are the facts and figures.
Thanks, Jean. New South Wales independent schools enrol a very few low-income students. By Trevor Cobald and published on the 17th of May. It is fascinating to see how independent schools and their lobby groups now resort to claiming they enrol many students from low-income families as justification for their overgenerous and ever-increasing taxpayer funding. The latest is the claim by Independent Schools New South Wales that they serve the needs of lower-income families. Catholic school organisations also make similar claims. The facts are that New South Wales independent and Catholic schools serve a very small proportion of low-income students, and only a tiny proportion of schools are disadvantaged. It is New South Wales public schools that serve the vast majority of low-income families, and nearly all disadvantaged schools in New South Wales are public schools. Moreover, public schools are vastly underfunded to meet the learning needs of these students, while independent and Catholic schools are very well resourced to meet the learning needs of their students. Nearly one-third, 32%, of students in New South Wales public schools are from families in the lowest socio-educationally advantaged quartile, according to data published by the Australian Curriculum Reporting and Assessment Authority, ACARA, compared to only 10% of independent schools and 16% of Catholic students. By contrast, 45% of independent school students are from the highest SEA quartile, compared to 22% in public schools. Also, a higher proportion of Catholic school students, 26%, are from the highest SEA quartile than in public schools. Independent Schools New South Wales also claims its schools largely serve below average income families. However, only 27% of its students are from the two lowest SEA quartiles, compared to 56% of public schools students. Some 73% of independent school students are from the highest two SEA quartiles. Furthermore, 81% of all New South Wales students are in the lowest SEA quartile attend public schools, compared to 7% in independent schools and 12% in Catholic schools. Disadvantaged schools are concentrated in the New South Wales public sector. In 2023, 94% of schools with more than 50% of their students in the lowest SEA quartile were public schools. Only 4% of independent schools and only 1% of Catholic schools had more than half their students in the lowest SEA quartile. Public schools also dominate other measures of disadvantaged concentration. They account for 93.1% of schools with over 75% of students from the lowest SEA quartile and 89% of schools with 30% or more students from the lowest SEA quartile. One third of all New South Wales public schools are highly disadvantaged, with over 50% of their students from the lowest SEA families. Only 2% of Catholic schools and 8% of independent schools have such a high concentration of low SEA students. Moreover, 62% of public schools have over 30% of their enrolments from low SEA students, compared to 16% of Catholic schools and 21% of independent schools. Another measure of the relative burden carried by public and private schools is to compare the ratio of income per student in public schools to that in private schools, with the ratios of low SEA enrolments in public and private schools. If private schools had the same disadvantage burden as public schools, their low SEA enrolment ratios would be similar to their income ratio. This is clearly not the case in New South Wales because there are huge differences between the income and low SEA enrolment ratios. Total income per student in public schools is similar to the income per student in Catholic schools, but the percentage of low SEA students is 201% of that in Catholic schools. This indicates that the disadvantage burden in public schools is double that of Catholic schools. The burden for public schools is even higher relative to independent schools. Income per student in public schools is only 69% of that in independent schools, yet the proportion of low SEA students in public schools is 326% of that in independent schools. The claim by Independent Schools New South Wales that their schools mainly serve lower than average income families is false. They serve upper income families, with 45% of families in the top SEA quartile and 73% of families in the top two quartiles, and only 27% in the bottom two quartiles. The burden of disadvantaged students in independent schools is minor compared to that facing public schools. The claims by Independent Schools New South Wales are a classic deflection tactic. They use their small proportion of low-income students to defend their overgenerous taxpayer funding for their privileged clientele. New South Wales independent schools are overfunded at 102% of their schooling resource standard, and in 2026, according to official figures, these ignore substantial overfunding accrued by major flaws in the method of assessing their need for taxpayer funding that result in substantial overfunding. By contrast, New South Wales public schools are massively underfunded at 90% of their SRS after adjusting for accounting tricks that allow the New South Wales government to claim it is spending more on public schools than in reality. False claims by Independent Schools New South Wales must not be allowed to deflect from the urgent needs of public schools and disadvantaged students in public schools. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much, Andy. And I think it's time for a break. But before we go for a break, we'd like to remind you that we want to keep the Dogs on the air and we want to keep 3CR on the air. And the Radiothon's coming up. The Dogs are looking for about $4,000 to $5,000 for 3CR on the 13th of June. But now let's have a break while you consider your bank balance.
It may have been Camelot for Jack and Jacqueline, but on the Che Guevara highway filling up.
Hello, this is a short message from 3CR. We're a community radio station, and right now we're seeking community donations so we can keep the station going. Please consider what you can donate to help us stay on air. Full details at 3cr.org.au/donate.
Jungle sales are organised and pamphlets have been posted. Even after closing time, there's still parties to be hosted. You can be active with the activists or sleeping with the sleepers while you're waiting for the drive forward.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program because we have a very interesting report from the Rationalist Society. A couple of years ago, the Albanese government, knowing that people were a bit restive of how religious societies are charities and they get exemption from taxation. And there was a report about the question of taxation exemptions for things called charities. And the report's been down for some time, but the Albanese government in its own way is dragging its feet. Let's hear about it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. RSA urges federal government to act on religious charities 2 years on from recommendations. The Rationalist Society of Australia has again urged the federal government to get on with reforming religious charities to restore public confidence in the nation's charity system, noting it has been 2 years of inaction since receiving key recommendations. In a letter to the responsible Minister for Charities, Andrew Lee, this week, the RSA asked whether the government would formally support the Productivity Commission's 2024 recommendation to remove basic religious charities, BRCs, from the nation's charity system. 2 years ago, on 10th of May 2024, the Productivity Commission handed the government its report from its Future Foundations for Giving inquiry. Typically, governments table their responses to such reports in the Houses of Parliament, but the Albanese government is yet to do so. Among the recommendations, the Productivity Commission called for the removal of the BRC category from the Australian Charities and Not-for-Profits Commission, the ACNC, Act 2012, so as to enhance regulatory consistency and public transparency. The Productivity Commission said it could not identify a policy rationale that justifies retaining BRCs. BRCs, organisations with charity status for advancing religion, enjoy exemptions to the governance standards and financial reporting requirements that apply to all other charities, even to some religious organisations that do not have the BRC status. The Productivity Commission also recommended removal of deductible gift recipient DGR status for religious education activities in government schools and all activities for the purpose of advancing religion, plus removal of DGR status for school building funds, as donations to such funds overwhelmingly benefiting the wealthiest, mostly faith-based private schools. As the RSA reported in September last year, Senator David Shoebridge sought answers from the government on who was tasked with working on a response to the report and why it was taking so long. In his letter this week, RSA Executive Director Cy Gladman said the government needed to adopt the Productivity Commission's recommendations relating to BRCs to help restore public trust and confidence in the charities system. He urged Dr. Lee to also listen to the charity's regulator, the ACNC, on the issue. On several occasions in recent years, the ACNC has publicly stated that the exemptions for BRCs may be reducing public trust and confidence in the charity's system. Last year, in a submission to the Victorian Parliamentary Inquiry into Cults, the ACNC said that the differences between the obligations of BRCs and other charities could impact the public's trust and confidence in the charity sector. The ACNC added that some religious charities' exemptions to reporting requirements and governance standards significantly impacts its ability to act when public concerns are raised about charities. According to ACNC data from last year, Australia has 13,872 charities registered for the purpose of advancing religion, with 7,742 of these being charities self-identified as BRCs. Although it has not tabled its full response to the Productivity Commission's report, the Albanese government has been announcing separate policies in response to the inquiry. In response to Senator Shoebridge's questions last year, Treasurer Jim Chalmers said the government had agreed to remove the condition that a gift to a DGR gift be valued at $2 or more before the donor may claim a tax deduction, and align and increase the minimum annual distribution rate for public and private ancillary funds. Upon the public release of the Productivity Commission's report in mid-2024, Dr. Lee swiftly rejected the recommendation that DGR status be removed for school building funds. In a speech in 2024, Dr. Lee said the government would be taking its time to respond to the report, as it wanted to allow a reasonable window for a direct conversation with the sector as we consider its recommendations. Religious lobbyists responded angrily to the Productivity Commission's recommendations, describing the independent research and advisory body as having a clear anti-religion agenda and as having mounted a direct attack on faith communities. Back to you, Jane.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. And now we have another report. It's actually a very sad report, really, because it's about how a very well-known Roman Catholic order has avoided at all costs using our money probably for legal costs to stop paying the victims of sexual abuse. Let's hear from Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This article is from the Saturday paper by Judy Corton. The Marist Brothers' Cruel Treatment of Abuse Victims. Despite vowing to support those who had suffered sexual abuse in their institutions, the Marist Brothers are uniquely aggressive in using the law to crush accusers. Some things are so wrong, so indecent, so shameful, they demand an exposé. In March last year, I wrote a piece for this paper about the High Court case of Bird versus DP, in which the court agreed with the Catholic Church that priests, brothers, and nuns were not employed. This decision, warmly embraced by the church, created profound injustice for thousands of victim survivors, in that they could not sue the church for the lifelong harm caused by being sexually assaulted as children. In February, the High Court handed down another decision that in many ways superseded Bird versus DP. In the case of AA versus the trustees of the Roman Catholic Church for the Diocese of Maitland, Newcastle, the High Court found the Catholic diocese had breached what is called their non-delegable duty of care to prevent harm to a child. Contrary to the impacts of the Bird v. DP judgment, this decision makes it much more difficult for an institution to fight liability in institutional abuse claims. As a result, many institutions, especially the Catholic Church, are using the worst parts of the law to crucify victims of childhood sexual abuse and physical assaults. One group has been particularly vicious in fighting compensation claims, the Marist Brothers. I would have acted for more than 40 survivors of Marist Brothers abuse, says Laird MacDonald, a principal at Rightside Legal. I think they fight cases in a way to make it harder for survivors. There is a disconnect in the way they approach a case, which can feel like a scorched earth strategy where nothing is admitted, and their public statements where they say they want to help people wounded by abuse. The Marist Brothers continue to support individuals who've been convicted of sexually abusing children and then get their lawyers to write a letter threatening to take the house of a survivor. Their actions speak louder than their words. Angela Cedrini's Legal, which frequently represents abuse survivors, has the same story. Our experience with the Marist Brothers is generally negative. Their conduct, in our view, is one of the worst in the abuse space. Some of our clients have expressed that they feel that the Marists use the litigation process to wear them down so that they settle for less than their claims are potentially worth. Whilst we recognise that the adversarial legal process is a blunt instrument in abuse cases, we regularly deal with defendants who have a much more trauma-informed approach. In reality, there is no truth or transparency. The Marists have instead become the most vicious denomination in using the law to defend their financial interests, protect pedophiles, and hurt survivors. Recently, I had a client who was abused in a Marist boarding school in the 1970s. One of the men who abused him is a convicted pedophile, but the church still fought his claim for compensation. Our client was adopted, and the school where he boarded was chillingly violent. It severely traumatized him, leaving him isolated, psychiatrically injured, and highly vulnerable. At the age of 70, he has been diagnosed with multiple psychiatric conditions, including PTSD, which was caused by the crimes against him as a boarder. He continues to self-medicate. He has suffered social withdrawal, frequent anger, and impairments in concentration and learning. He had multiple broken relationships, was unable to hold down a job, and for many years was an alcoholic and cannabis user. He also spent time in jail for cannabis-related offences. One of the Marist Brothers who abused him was moved between about 20 schools in his almost 50-year career as a teacher, sportsmaster, principal, chaplain, student welfare coordinator and student counsellor. He has previously been sentenced in 2005, 2016, 2020 and 2024 for sexually assaulting boys under the age of 16. His sentences were wholly suspended for the first two matters, and only about 6 months were served for each of the three-year sentences for the last two matters. Despite all this, the man remains fully supported by the Maris brothers. He retains the honorific brother. The Maris brothers fought our client's civil claim for more than 6 years. Where matters such as this are often settled before trial, our client's was not, and increasingly other plaintiff law firms report a similar approach. The Maris briefed an experienced, fiery criminal defence barrister to cross-examine our client. The process was slow and draining. Our client was cross-examined on 500 pages of his once confidential counselling records. His most deeply held private thoughts, his experiences and worries were exposed for all to see and mercilessly used against him. At the beginning of the fourth day of cross-examination by a very experienced criminal barrister, our client collapsed emotionally and physically. He was eviscerated and the trial was abandoned. If the Maris brothers aren't leaving plaintiffs broken in the witness box, they are often making non-offers. They will offer no compensation, with parties to bear their own legal costs. These insulting non-offers follow a consistent pattern across multiple firms and multiple cases and are damaging to survivors. The Maris brothers would have spent about 4 to 5 times more on their own legal team fighting our vulnerable client than our client would have accepted in compensation prior to the trial. Our client would have settled rather than face the ordeal of a trial, which the Maris brothers chose to force upon him despite his willingness to settle. The Maris brothers briefed counsel, whose approach, a drawn-out, relentless, aggressive and primed cross-examination, left our client broken and dehumanized. These are the legal tactics used to crush the already shattered victims of heinous crimes committed by those in the Maris brothers' own institutions. This is not an isolated example. Other clients of my firm who were sexually assaulted as children at Maris Brothers schools face similar hostilities. The same tactics are being deployed against victims represented by other plaintiff law firms. It is well evidenced that children who are sexually assaulted can take decades to disclose the crimes, if ever. Pedophiles are clever. They mess with the young mind of the child, causing them to feel deep shame, guilt and confusion. This is what silences the victims and why the pedophiles and their enablers go undetected for so long. The Maris brothers weaponized our client's delayed disclosure against him despite overwhelming and accepted evidence that delayed disclosure is a hallmark of childhood sexual abuse, not an indicator of fabrication. Now that the latest High Court decision makes it even harder for institutions to skulk their way out of liability, the Maris brothers have joined the angry world of litigation. The pattern of conduct across multiple firms suggests that asset protection has overtaken any genuine commitment to survivors. They will attack, vilify, and shatter psychiatrically harmed victims. Despite all this, the Maris brothers claim to be model litigants. During the Royal Commission into the Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse, they said in a statement, "Any victim of sexual abuse deserves a response that is as just and compassionate as possible, and one that contributes as much as it can to assisting that person to rebuild his or her well-being and self-belief." In another statement at the time, the religious order said, "In all of this, the Maris brothers are determined to ensure that each and every victim, without exception, is heard and receives healing and justice." The Maris brothers' own policies and standards dictate that truth and transparency should characterize all actions. What lies and deception? In reality, there is no truth or transparency. The Marists have instead become the most vicious denomination in using the law to defend their financial interests, protect pedophiles, and hurt survivors. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much for all of that. Now let's go to a completely different subject. Our teachers are terribly important, you know, and the state government is dragging its feet on giving them proper remuneration. And the union say that they have some kind of negotiated settlement, but our information is that not all of the teachers are happy about it and they haven't yet voted, and some could well be voting no. For many years, of course, the dogs have found the Victorian Teachers Union is a bit too close to the Labor Party, and some of the teachers feel this too. But we're going to talk about AI, which has been in the news and is in our classrooms. And there's a question as to whether or not it's going to replace our teachers. And here is a very interesting article about Microsoft's big AI play for Australian classrooms. Over to Andy once again.
Thanks, Jean. Inside Microsoft's big AI play for Australian classrooms. And this was published in The Educator on the 13th of May, written by Brett Henneberry. In 2026, Australia's AI challenge is no longer just teaching students how to use the technology. Teachers are now expected to help them understand when to trust it, when to question it, and when to switch it off altogether. As this technology continues to shake up classrooms and workplaces, experts warn schools must move quickly to build safe, practical, and responsible habits around its use. In April, Microsoft Elevate for Educators announced a major initiative to provide free training, practical resources, and professional support for Australian teachers and school leaders to adopt AI safely, responsibly, and in ways that make a meaningful improvement to teaching and learning. The program includes a globally recognised AI Literacy for Educators credential alongside implementation guidance and classroom-ready tools, with the broader goal of ensuring students leave school better equipped to understand, question and use AI in the real world. From a principal's perspective, it takes clear purpose, visible leadership, practical guardrails, and repeated opportunities for staff to build confidence in low-risk, high-value ways, Sean Tierney, K-12 industry advisor for Microsoft Elevate Asia, told The Educator. The schools that maintain momentum are the ones that connect AI to real priorities, reducing workload, improving feedback, supporting differentiation, and helping students move beyond recall into evaluation, synthesis, and justification. What successful AI adoption looks like. Tierney said Brisbane Catholic Education's BCE experience shows what this can look like in practice. Their co-pilot rollout had a substantial impact, reaching over 12,500 educators and staff, he said. Students leveraged co-pilot to brainstorm, develop their ideas and boost their confidence, while teachers experienced notable time savings on administrative tasks. Tierney said Copilot 13 Plus is now being rolled out to secondary school students, whilst the AI-enhanced Microsoft Learning Accelerators is concurrently being rolled out to primary students. This will mean that up to 80,000 students at BCE will have the opportunity to be learning with AI, with teachers creating specific learning tasks to avoid cognitive offloading and teaching students when best to use AI, he said. The key was not treating AI as a one-off training event. BCE embedded professional learning into existing routines through microsessions, collaborative planning, and in-class coaching, and identified AI captains to support peers. Tierney said the success of BCE's rollout was driven by embedding AI gradually into daily practice, giving staff practical support, and building confidence through trusted peer-led collaboration. That kind of model helps adoption grow through trust, peer modelling and practical wins, so AI becomes part of the school's everyday teaching and operating rhythm rather than just another short-lived technology initiative. Making AI manageable for teachers. With many teachers still getting comfortable with the digital technologies curriculum, Tierney suggested introducing AI as a way to reduce workload and strengthen existing teaching practice, not as an additional program sitting beside the digital technologies curriculum. School leaders can begin by identifying the routines teachers already do every week, planning lessons, adapting resources, creating assessment rubrics, drafting feedback, communicating with families and differentiating learning, and showing where AI can safely save time or improve quality, he said. Leaders also need to make AI literacy practical and confidence building. Teachers do not need to become technical experts before they start. They need clear guidance on responsible use, privacy, bias, checking outputs, and keeping professional judgments at the centre. Tierney said short, practical, professional learning built into existing staff meetings, faculty planning and coaching cycles will feel much more manageable than a separate training burden. Programs such as Microsoft Elevate for Educators can support this by helping teachers build AI literacy in the context of real classroom practice and student learning, rather than treating AI as an isolated technology skill. Safe AI use starts with responsible leadership. Tierney said principals need to be hands-on in setting the conditions for safe use, even if they are not involved in every student interaction. That means approving which tools can be used, setting clear expectations for staff and students, ensuring privacy and data protections are understood, and making sure AI is used within the school's duty of care and wellbeing frameworks, he said. Using institution-approved tools rather than public AI tools is an important starting point because it helps maintain data confidentiality, governance, and control over educational content. Tierney said strong oversight and clear safeguards are essential when introducing AI-powered career guidance tools into schools, particularly when student wellbeing, privacy, and decision-making are involved. Career Coach, developed by our partners Anyway, is an enterprise solution, working with multiple state governments departments both in Australia and in the US, so by default has built-in safeguards and privacy guardrails, he said. However, like any technology tool within education, it should always be implemented by the school leadership and teaching staff to ensure safe and correct usage and human oversight. Tierney said tools like Career Coach are there to support exploration, not make decisions for students, adding that while AI can help students brainstorm pathways, prepare questions, reflect on interests and understand options, it should not replace counsellors, teachers, families or the students' own judgment. Students need to be taught not to share unnecessary personal or sensitive information, to test AI suggestions against trusted human advice and to see career guidance as a conversation rather than an answer generated by a machine, he said. That is how AI can reduce pressure on counsellors while keeping important life decisions firmly human-led. Back to you, Jane.
Well, it's time for our international news, and Australia is very much involved in this too, because more and more, particularly our universities, but also our schools and our businesses, are very involved in the internet and AI and the new technology. There's been, if you haven't noticed, a technological revolution all around the world. But then you've got your baddies as well as your goodies. And there has been a hack, a Canvas hack, which has affected a large number of students in Australia. But it looks as if the hackers have been rewarded. Let's hear about it from Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article by Josh Taylor. The Canvas hack. Is it ever a good idea to pay a ransom? And what happens to the data? Businesses are advised against paying, but many are prepared to deal to protect users' privacy. After a week of outages, hundreds of millions of students' data stolen, delayed assignment due dates, and school login pages being defaced by hackers, the US tech firm Instructure, which operates the education platform Canvas, used by education providers worldwide, announced it had reached an agreement with the unauthorized actor behind the ransomware attack. Experts read the careful language as a sign that a ransom has been paid. The company has not confirmed this. The question of whether firms should pay ransomware attackers to regain access to their systems and potentially prevent further harm from the release of personal information of, in some case, millions, is one that thousands of companies face each year. Although governments across the globe advise against it, many ultimately do. The hacking group Shiny Hunters claimed responsibility for the attack on Instructure. It had threatened to leak the reported 3.6 terabytes of data comprising of student ID numbers, email addresses, names and messages from 9,000 schools and 275 million students and staff worldwide unless the company paid the ransom. In Australia, more than two dozen universities and public and private schools in several states were victims of the attack. RMIT and UTS were among those to grant extensions on assignments as frustrated students were unable to access the portal. Instructure later confirmed that the hackers had exploited a vulnerability in its Free for Teacher software that allowed them to deface login pages, such as that for the University of Texas, San Antonio, to alert users to the breach. The company said this week that the data had been returned to it as part of the agreement it reached with the hackers, and also that it was shown digital confirmation of data destruction via shred logs, a technical report that is generated by a program that processes data to be destroyed in a way that makes it no longer recoverable. While there is never complete certainty when dealing with cybercriminals, we believe it was important to take every step within our control to give customers additional peace of mind to the extent possible, the company said last week. The head of cyber at cyber forensics accounting firm McGraw-Nickel, Darren Hopkins, says Canvas's statement was well crafted in a way that doesn't necessarily admit anything, but also does demonstrate that they've got an agreement. Shiny Hunters is an extortion group, he says. This is what they do. What other agreement will they come up with? An Aegis cybersecurity expert, Luke Irwin, estimates that based on reported ransom demands of US $10 million, it's possible Instructure or its insurance underwriter paid somewhere up to that amount, but he says it's also possible it was negotiated down. Instructure is dealing with a criminal organization, and you are taking them at their word that they will commit to those outcomes, he said. That is a risk-driven position Instructure needs to work within. Most governments advise against paying ransom, including in the UK, the US, and Australia, but outright bans are rare, says the tech firm Akami in its 2025 Ransomware State of the Industry report. If ransoms are not paid, then the effectiveness of the attack vector is reduced and potentially becomes less attractive to hacker groups, the report says. In Australia, it could be a criminal offence to pay an attacker that is designated under the Autonomous Cyber Sanctions Law. The Sanctions Office says it will consider any payment made on a case-by-case basis as to whether it's referred to prosecution. Payments could fund other criminal activities, and ultimately there's no guarantee that paying a ransom or extortion would prevent the release of data or end the threats, Akami says. Under Australia's mandatory reporting obligations that came into effect at the end of May last year, 75 businesses with turnovers of at least $3 million a year had paid ransoms as of the end of January 2026. The government does not disclose how much was paid. A McGraw-Nickel ransomware report from November surveyed 800 executives from Australian businesses with 50 or more employees and found the average amount paid in Australia was $711,000, down from $1.35 million the year before. The report found 64% had decided to pay a ransom, and 81% of businesses said they would hypothetically be willing to pay a ransom. Hopkins says businesses are getting better at preparing for a cyber attack, meaning that they're less likely to pay to get hackers to unlock the locked systems. Instead, businesses are more focused on trying to stop further harm by paying the hackers, releasing the data. Canvas was interesting because we all suspected Instructure was engaged with a threat actor very quickly because they were on the leak site and the posting got removed from it. How honest is that criminal? The question Hopkins gets asked in boardrooms across Australia when training businesses on cyber attacks is, will making a payment stop data being exposed? That question around how honest is that criminal comes up all the time, he says. The business model of hackers needs them to show that they are honest because no one would ever pay them. So it's a big trust factor. Irwin says it's in Shiny Hunter's interest to act in good faith as an example to other organisations who may be compromised, so future victims would be more inclined to pay. But Hopkins adds, you can't rely on them to not be what they are, which is criminals. They'll go off and give us screenshots saying, here's us deleting things. You don't know if they've made a copy or what they've done beyond that. They will show you what you need to see, so you'll make your payment, and you've got no access to validate any of these things. Back to you, Jean.
Well, let's have a quick break from all of the sad news, shall we? And we'll come back for the good news.
3CR programs provide information and analysis you won't hear in the mainstream.
Today we'll be looking at the legacy of the US war on Vietnam on Laos.
And as far as corporate capitalism is concerned, it is the worst political and economic system that you can have.
Our laws about jailing refugees and asylum seekers are so well crafted.
Sex is not irrelevant, and we like who we are, but we don't have to be imprisoned by our gender.
Become a subscriber today. Call us on 9419 8377 or visit 3cr.org.au. 3CR, the voice of dissent.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program for our good news section. And this is a particularly lovely school. We're choosing the schools, by the way, who had representatives at the big protest march of the teachers about a month ago. But here's Andy with our Great State School of the Week.
Thanks, Jean. And this week's Great State School of the Week is Jacana School for Autism. Jacana School for Autism is a Victorian state government specialist school that exclusively addresses the educational needs of students with autism. The school was established in 2013 to meet the needs of increasing numbers of students with autism in the northwestern Victoria region. Jacana School for Autism is located off the Western Ring Road, close to public transport, Broadmeadows Shopping Centre, Broadmeadows Leisure Centre and the Hume Global Learning Centre and Library. Funding from the Building the Educational Revolution provided a high-quality refurbishment of the facilities. The school currently caters for 228 students from 5 to 18 years of age. Jacana School for Autism is a primary and secondary years provider. The school embraces the positive behaviour support philosophy and practices. Class groups generally comprise 8 students of similar chronological age. Teachers and teacher aides generally work in teams of 3 in each classroom and are supported by speech and occupational therapists, specialist teachers in physical education, visual and performing arts, and design and technology, leading teachers, and the school psychologist. The facilities: secure, modern, age-appropriate playgrounds, multi-purpose room, student gym, specialist performing arts room, specialist visual arts room, student library, climbing gym, 2 occupational therapy rooms, student gardens, primary and secondary healthy living kitchens, a community learning hub, and a walking/bike track, including a large recreational learning space.
There are many different types of student supports at Jacana School for Autism. In addition to the personal and social capabilities curriculum that is delivered to all students, the school engages with canine comprehension, a specialist program designed to harness the power of animal-assisted intervention, AAI, with well-trained certified therapy dogs. The AAI program, differentiated according to age and learning levels, provides targeted social emotional SE learning opportunities to various cohorts throughout the year to further develop their understanding and skills in social communication and interaction, including empathy for others and relationships, as well as recognizing and regulating their own emotions to foster their self-worth, self-awareness, and personal identity. And here's an excerpt from 10 News about canine comprehension, the provider of the therapy dogs, and their work at Jacana School for Autism.
More Victorian students will soon have access to animal therapy in the classroom. 101 of the state's schools will share in more than $1.7 million in a bid to boost learning and social skills.
Man's best friend turned classroom buddy.
Now? Good boy.
Little Victor is making a big difference to students at the Takana School for Autism.
There's something really special between our students and the therapy dogs.
Training Victor is top notch because it works on tone, communication, being clear, understanding different emotions.
Animal-assisted wellbeing and engagement programs are even enticing some students back into the classroom.
Have increased their days of engagement at school and even now attending full-time.
They do actually reduce serotonin levels of the students. They can really help with stress. Not only that, they're a really great catalyst for conversation and learning.
The therapy dog program's been running here for just over 2 years, but new state funding means more children at this school and dozens of others across the state can access that program and ones like it.
Animals are great for everyone. We've seen the benefits, but this is particularly for kids that don't often have that opportunity or need that extra help with connection. I think it's a great program.
Ultimately, the state government is eager for programs like this to be rolled out at all of the state's specialist schools. Another round of grant applications will open in term two.
It's really important to think outside the box. We want for our teachers and for our students, for the students to be calm, to be engaged and to be happy.
Ashley Kanowski for 10 News First.
And now some facts and figures from the My School website. The school currently has 228 students and the ICSEA value slightly below average. This puts 16% of students in the top 25% of socio-educational advantage, 21% in the second quartile, 28% that is below average socio-educational advantage, and 34% in the bottom quartile of socio-educational advantage, with 4% Indigenous students and 60% having a language background other than English. The finances, federal funding $3.1 million and state funding $11.8 million. Fees, charges and parent contributions add another $14,000 and other private contributions $152,000. And that means the per student expenditure is $68,387, reflecting the fact that students with higher needs require more investment. The capital expenditure, $10.8 million over the last 3 years. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to the Takana Autism School out there in the Glenroy area. I know that some parents have had to move just so that their children can go there. It has a very, very good reputation. But our time is gone, and it's up to me now to thank our wonderful producer, Dale, and her offsider, Andy, and remind you that Radiothon is coming up. And also remind you, if you want to know more about the dogs, you don't just have to go to AI. You can go to our website at www.adogs.info. But from all of us here at 3CR, it's bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find your hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. We're almost ready to begin 3CR's annual Radiothon, where we raise funds to stay on air for another year. The dog's target this year is $4,500, so if you're able to pledge anything to help us reach our target, please contact the station. Call 03-9419-8377 during business hours, or go to www.3cr.org.au for more details.